Gutters were filled with drifts of unidentifiable metal junk and bright glints of glass. Trees had been planted at intervals along the sidewalks in some long-gone happier time, but they were now so emphatically dead that they looked like stark metal sculptures against the cloudy sky. Some of the warehouses had either been bombed or had collapsed on their own, and beyond the jumbled heaps of bricks, which was all that remained of them, Jake could see the river and the rusty, sagging underpinnings of the Send Bridge. That smell of wet decay, a smell that seemed almost a snarl in the nose, was stronger than ever. The street headed due east, diverging from the path of the beam, and Jake could see it became more and more choked with rubble and rickrack as it went. 6 or 7 blocks down, it appeared to be entirely plugged, but it was in this direction that Gasher pulled him. At first he kept up, but Gasher was setting a fearsome pace. Jake began to pant and fell a step behind. Gasher almost jerked him off his feet as he dragged Jake toward the barriers of junk and concrete and rusty steel beams which lay ahead. The plug, which looked like a deliberate construction to Jake, lay between 2 broad buildings with dusty marble facades. In front of the one on the left was a statue Jake recognized at once. It was the woman called Blind Justice, and that almost surely made the building she guarded a courthouse. But he only had a moment to look. Gasher was dragging him relentlessly toward the barricade, and he wasn't slowing down. "He'll kill us if he tries to take us through there," Jake thought. But Gasher, who ran like the wind, in spite of the disease which advertised itself on his face, simply buried his fingers deeper in Jake's upper arm and swept him along. And now Jake saw a narrow alley in the not-quite-haphazard pile of concrete, splintered furniture, rusted plumbing fixtures, and chunks of trucks and automobiles. He suddenly understood. This maze would hold Roland up for hours, but it was Gasher's backyard, and he knew exactly where he was going. The small, dark opening to the alley was on the left side of the tottery pile of junk. As they reached it, Gasher tossed the green object back over his shoulder.
"Better duck, dearie,"
he cried, and voiced a series of shrill, hysterical giggles. A moment later, a huge, crumping explosion shook the street. One of the bubble-shaped cars jumped 20 feet into the air and then came down on its roof. A hail of bricks whistled over Jake's head, and something thumped him hard on the left shoulder blade. He stumbled and would have fallen if Gasher hadn't yanked him upright and pulled him into the narrow opening in the rubble. Once they were in the passageway which lay beyond, gloomy shadows reached out eagerly and enfolded them. When they were gone, a small furry shape crept out from behind a concrete boulder. It was Oi. He stood at the mouth of the passage for a moment, neck stretched forward, eyes gleaming. Then he followed after, nose low to the ground and sniffing carefully. XV. "Come on," Roland said as soon as Gasher had turned tail.
"How could you do it?"
Eddie asked.
"How could you let that freak have him?"
"Because I had no choice. Bring the wheelchair. We're going to need it." They had reached the concrete on the far side of the gap when an explosion shook the bridge, spraying rubble into the darkening sky.
"Christ!"
Eddie said, and turned his white, dismayed face to Roland. "Don't worry yet," Roland said calmly. "Fellows like Gasher rarely get careless with their high-explosive toys." They reached the toll booths at the end of the bridge. Roland stopped just beyond, at the top of the curving ramp.
"You knew the guy wasn't just bluffing, didn't you?"
Eddie said.
"I mean, you weren't guessing, you knew."
"He's a walking dead man, and such men don't need to bluff." Roland's voice was calm enough, but there was a deep undertone of bitterness and pain in it. "I knew something like this could happen. And if we'd seen the fellow earlier, while we were still beyond the range of his exploding egg, we could have stood him off. But then Jake fell, and he got too close. I imagine he thinks our real reason for bringing a boy in the first place was to pay for safe conduct through the city. Damn! Damn the luck!" Roland struck his fist against his leg.
"Well, let's go get him."
Roland shook his head. "This is where we split up. We can't take Susanna where the bastard's gone, and we can't leave her alone. But listen and don't argue, not if you want to save Jake. The longer we stand here, the colder his trail gets. Cold trails are hard to follow.
You've got your own job to do. If there's another Blaine, and I am sure Jake believes there is, then you and Susanna must find it. There must be a station, or what was once called a cradle, in the far lands. Do you understand?
For once, blessedly, Eddie didn't argue.
Yeah, we'll find it. What then?
Fire a shot every half hour or so. When I get Jake, I'll come.
Shots may attract other people as well, Susanna said.
Eddie had helped her out of the sling, and she was seated in her chair again.
Roland surveyed them coldly.
Handle them.
Okay.
Eddie stuck out his hand, and Roland took it briefly.
Find him, Roland.
Oh, I'll find him. Just pray to your gods that I find him soon enough. And remember the faces of your fathers, both of you.
Susanna nodded.
We'll try.
Roland turned and ran, light-footed, down the ramp. When he was out of sight, Eddie looked at Susanna and was not very surprised to see she was crying. He felt like crying himself. Half an hour ago, they had been a tight little band of friends. Their comfortable fellowship had been smashed to bits in the space of just a few minutes. Jake abducted, Roland gone after him, even Oi had run away. Eddie had never felt so lonely in his life.
I have a feeling we're never going to see either of them again, Susanna said.
Of course we will, Eddie said roughly. But he knew what she meant, because he felt the same way. The premonition that their quest was all over before it was fairly begun lay heavy on his heart.
In a fight with Attila the Hun, I'd give you 3-2 odds on Roland the Barbarian. Come on, Suze, we've got a train to catch.
But where?
She asked forlornly.
I don't know. Maybe we should just find the nearest wise old elf and ask him, huh?
What are you talking about, Edward Dean?
Nothing, he said.
And because that was so goddamn true he thought he might burst into tears, he grasped the handles of her wheelchair and began to push it down the cracked and glass-littered ramp that led into the City of Lud. Jake quickly descended into a foggy world where the only landmarks were pain, his throbbing hand, the place on his upper arm where Gasher's fingers dug in like steel pegs, his burning lungs. Before they had gone far, these pains were first joined and then overmatched by a deep burning stitch in his left side. He wondered if Roland was following after them yet. He also wondered how long Oi would be able to live in this world which was so unlike the plains and forest which were all he had known until now. Then Gasher clouded him across the face, bloodying his nose, and thought was lost in a red wash of pain.
Come on here, little bastard, move your sweet cheeks!
Running as fast as I can,
Jake gasped, and just managed to dodge a thick shard of glass which jutted like a long, transparent tooth from the wall of junk to his left.
You better not be, because I'll knock your cold and drag you along by the hair of your head if you are. Now hop, you little bastard!
Jake somehow forced himself to run faster. He'd gone into the alley with the idea that they must shortly reemerge onto the avenue, but he now reluctantly realized that wasn't going to happen. This was more than an alley. It was a camouflaged and fortified road, leading ever deeper into the country of the Greys. The tall, tottery walls which pressed in on them had been built from an exotic array of materials. Cars, which had been partially or completely flattened by the chunks of granite and steel placed on top of them, marble pillars, unknown factory machines which were dull red with rust wherever they weren't still black with grease, a chrome and crystal fish as big as a private plane with one cryptic word of the high speech, delight, carefully incised into its scaly, gleaming side, crisscrossing chains, each link as big as Jake's head, wrapped around mad jumbles of furniture that appeared to balance above them as precariously as circus elephants do on their tiny steel platforms. They came to a place where this lunatic path branched, and Gasher chose the left fork without hesitation. A little further along, three more alleyways, these so narrow they were almost tunnels, spoked off in various directions. This time Gasher chose the right-hand branching. The new path, which seemed to be formed by banks of rotting boxes and huge blocks of old paper, paper that might once have been books or magazines, was too narrow for them to run in side by side. Gasher shoved Jake into the lead and began beating him relentlessly on the back to make him go faster. This is how a steer must feel when it's driven down the chute to the slaughtering pen, Jake thought, and vowed that if he got out of this alive, he would never eat steak again.
Run, my sweet little boy cunt, run!
Jake soon lost all track of the twistings and turnings they made, and as Gasher drove him deeper and deeper into this jumble of torn steel, broken furniture, and cast-off machinery, he began to give up hope of rescue. Not even Roland would be able to find him now. If the gunslinger tried, he would become lost himself and wander the choked paths of this nightmare world until he died. Now they were going downhill, and the walls of tightly packed paper had given way to ramparts of filing cabinets, jumbles of adding machines, and piles of computer gear. It was like running through some nightmarish Radio Shack warehouse. For almost a full minute, the wall flowing past on Jake's left appeared to be constructed solely of either TV sets or carelessly stacked video display terminals. They stared at him like the glazed eyes of dead men. And as the pavement beneath their feet continued to descend, Jake realized that they were in a tunnel. The strip of cloudy sky overhead narrowed to a band, the band narrowed to a ribbon, and the ribbon became a thread. They were in a gloomy netherworld, scurrying like rats through a gigantic trash midden. What if it all comes down on us, Jake wondered. But in his current state of aching exhaustion, this possibility did not frighten him much. If the roof fell in, he would at least be able to rest. Gasher drove him as a farmer would a mule, striking his left shoulder to indicate a left turn and his right to indicate a right turn. When the course was straight on, he thumped Jake on the back of the head. Jake tried to dodge a jutting pipe and didn't quite succeed. It whacked into one hip and sent him flailing across the narrow passage toward a snarl of glass and jagged boards. Gasher caught him and shoved him forward again.
Run, you clumsy squint! Can't you run? If it wasn't for the tick-tock man, I'd burger you right here and cut your throat while I did it, so I would.
Jake ran in a red daze where there was only pain and the frequent thud of Gasher's fists coming down on his shoulders or the back of his head. At last, when he was sure he could run no longer, Gasher grabbed him by the neck and yanked him to a stop so fiercely that Jake crashed into him with a strangled squawk.
"Here's a tricky little bit," Gasher panted jovially. "Look straight ahead and you'll see two wires with crossing an X low to the ground. Do you see 'em?"
At first, Jake didn't. It was very gloomy here. Heaps of huge copper kettles were piled up to the left, and to the right were stacks of steel tanks that looked like scuba diving gear. Jake thought he could turn these latter into an avalanche with one strong breath. He swiped his forearm across his eyes, brushing away tangles of hair, and tried not to think about how he'd look with about 16 tons of those tanks piled on top of him. He squinted in the direction Gasher was pointing. Yes, he could make out, barely, two thin silvery lines that looked like guitar or banjo strings. They came down from opposite sides of the passageway and crossed about 2 feet above the pavement.
"Crawl under, dear heart, and be ever so careful, for if you so much as twang one of those wires, half the steel and cement puke in the city'll come down on your dear little head. Mine, too, although I doubt if that'd disturb you much, would it? Now crawl."
Jake shrugged out of his pack, lay down, and pushed it through the gap ahead of him. And as he eased his way under the thin, taut wires, he discovered that he wanted to live a little longer after all. It seemed that he could actually feel all those tons of carefully balanced junk waiting to come down on him. "These wires are probably holding a couple of carefully chosen keystones in place," he thought. "If one of them breaks, ashes, ashes, we all fall down." His back brushed one of the wires, and high overhead something creaked.
"Careful, Collie," Gasher almost moaned. "Be also careful."
Jake pushed himself beneath the crisscrossing wires using his feet and his elbows. His stinking, sweat-clogged hair fell in his eyes again, but he did not dare brush it away.
"You're clear,"
Gasher grunted at last, and slipped beneath the trip wires himself with the ease of long practice. He stood up and snatched Jake's pack before Jake could reshoulder it.
"What's in here, Collie?"
he asked, undoing the straps and peering in.
"Got any treats for your old pal? For the Gasher Man loves his treaties, so he does."
There's nothing in there but Gasher's hand flashed out and rocked Jake's head back with a hard slap that sent a fresh spray of bloody froth flying from the boy's nose.
"What did you do that for?" Jake cried, hurt and outraged. "For telling me what my own beshitted eyes can see,"
Gasher yelled, and cast Jake's pack aside. He bared his remaining teeth at the boy in a dangerous, terrible grin.
"And for almost bringing the whole beshitted works down on us!"
He paused, then added in a quieter voice,
"And because I felt like it, I must admit that. Your stupid sheep's face puts me very much in a slapping temper, so it does."
The grin widened, revealing his oozing, whitish gums, a sight Jake could have done without.
"If your hard case friend follows us this far, he'll have a surprise when he runs into those wires, won't he?"
Gasher looked up, still grinning.
"There's a city bus balanced up there someplace, as I remember."
Jake began to weep, tired, hopeless tears that cut through the dirt on his cheeks in narrow channels. Gasher raised an open, threatening hand.
"Get moving, Kelly, before I start crying myself. For a wary, sentimental feller is your old pal, so he is. And when he starts to grieve and mourn, a little slapping is the only thing to put a smile on his face again. Run!"
They ran. Gasher chose pathways leading deeper into the smelly, creaking maze, seemingly at random, indicating his choices with hard wax to the shoulders. At some point, the sound of the drums began. It seemed to come from everywhere and nowhere, and for Jake, it was the final straw. He gave up hope and thought alike, and allowed himself to descend wholly into the nightmare. 17. Roland halted in front of the barricade, which choked the street from side to side and top to bottom. Unlike Jake, he had no hopes of emerging into the open on the other side. The buildings lying east of this point would be sentry-occupied islands emerging from an inland sea of trash, tools, artifacts, and booby traps, he had no doubt. Some of these leavings undoubtedly still remained where they had fallen 500 or 700 or 1,000 years ago, but Roland thought most of it had been dragged here by the Greys a piece at a time. The eastern portion of Ludd had become, in effect, the castle of the Greys, and Roland was now standing outside its wall. He walked forward slowly and saw the mouth of a passageway half hidden behind a ragged cement boulder. There were footprints in the powdery dust, two sets, one big, one small. Roland started to get up, looked again, and squatted on his hunkers once more. Not two sets, but three, the third marking the paws of a small animal. "Oi?" Roland called softly. For a moment there was no response, and then a single soft bark came from the shadows. Roland stepped into the passageway and saw gold-ringed eyes peering at him from around the first crooked corner. Roland trotted down to the bumbler. Oi, who still didn't like to come really close to anyone but Jake, backed up a step and then held his ground, looking anxiously up at the gunslinger. "Do you want to help me?" Roland asked. He could feel the dry, red curtain that was battle fever at the edge of his consciousness, but this was not the time for it. The time would come, but for now he must not allow himself that inexpressible relief. "Help me find Jake?" "Jake!" Oi barked, still watching Roland with his anxious eyes. "Go on, then. Find him." Oi turned away at once and ran rapidly down the alley, nose skimming the ground. Roland followed, his eyes only occasionally flicking up to glance at Oi. Mostly he kept his gaze fixed on the ancient pavement, looking for sign. 18.
"Jesus," Eddie said. "What kind of people are these guys?"
They had followed the avenue at the base of the ramp for a couple of blocks, had seen the barricade, missing Roland's entry into the partially hidden passageway by less than a minute, which lay ahead, and had turned north onto a broad thoroughfare which reminded Eddie of Fifth Avenue. He hadn't dared to tell Susanna that. He was still too bitterly disappointed with this stinking, littered ruin of a city to articulate anything hopeful. Fifth Avenue led them into an area of large white stone buildings that reminded Eddie of the way Rome looked in the gladiator movies he'd watched on TV as a kid. They were austere and, for the most part, still in good shape. He was pretty sure they had been public buildings of some sort, galleries, libraries, maybe museums. One with a big domed roof that had cracked like a granite egg might have been an observatory. Although Eddie had read someplace that astronomers like to be away from big cities, because all the electric lights fucked up their stargazing. There were open areas between these imposing edifices, and although the grass and flowers which had once grown there had been choked off by weeds and tangles of underbrush, the area still had a stately feel, and Eddie wondered if it had once been the center of Ludd's cultural life. Those days were long gone, of course. Eddie doubted if Gasher and his pals were very interested in ballet or chamber music. He and Susanna had come to a major intersection from which four more broad avenues radiated outward like spokes on a wheel. At the hub of the wheel was a large paved square. Ringing it were loudspeakers on 40-foot steel posts. In the center of the square was a pedestal with the remains of a statue upon it, a mighty copper warhorse, green with verdigris, pawing its forelegs at the air. The warrior who had once ridden this charger lay off to the side on one corroded shoulder, waving what looked like a machine gun in one hand and a sword in the other. His legs were still bowed around the shape of the horse he had once ridden, but his boots remained welded to the sides of his metal mount. Gray's Die was written across the pedestal in fading orange letters. Glancing down the radiating streets, Eddie saw more of the speaker poles. A few had fallen over, but most still stood, and each of these had been festooned with a grisly garland of corpses. As a result, the square into which Fifth Avenue emptied and the streets which led away were guarded by a small army of the dead. "What kind of people are they?" Eddie asked again. He didn't expect an answer, and Susanna didn't give one. But she could have. She'd had insights into the past of Roland's world before, but never one as clear and sure as this. All of her earlier insights, like those which had come to her in River Crossing, had had a haunting visionary quality, like dreams. But what came now arrived in a single flash, and it was like seeing the twisted face of a dangerous maniac illuminated by a stroke of lightning. The speakers, the hanging bodies, the drums. She suddenly understood how they went together, as clearly as she had understood that the heavy-laden wagons passing through River Crossing on their way to Jimtown had been pulled by oxen rather than mules or horses.
"Never mind this trash," she said,
and her voice only quivered a little.
"It's a train we want. Which way is it, do you think?"
Eddie glanced up at the darkening sky and easily picked out the path of the beam in the rushing clouds. He looked back down and wasn't much surprised to see that the entrance to the street corresponding most closely to the path of the beam was guarded by a large stone turtle. Its reptilian head peered out from beneath the granite lip of its shell. Its deep-set eyes seemed to stare curiously at them. Eddie nodded toward it and managed a small, dry smile. "See the turtle of enormous girth?" Susanna took a brief look of her own and nodded. He pushed her across the city square and into the street of the turtle. The corpses which lined it gave off a dry, cinnamony smell that made Eddie's stomach clench. Not because it was bad, but because it was actually rather pleasant. The sugar-spicy aroma of something a kid would enjoy shaking onto his morning toast. The street of the turtle was mercifully broad, and most of the corpses hanging from the speaker poles were little more than mummies. But Susanna saw a few which were relatively fresh, with flies still crawling busily across the blackening skin of their swollen faces and maggots still squirming out of their decaying eyes. And below each speaker was a little drift of bones.
"There must be thousands," Eddie said. "Men, women, and kids."
"Yes." Susanna's calm voice sounded distant and strange to her own ears.
"They've had a lot of time to kill, and they've used it to kill each other. Bring on those wise fucking elves,
Eddie said, and the laugh that followed sounded suspiciously like a sob. He thought he was at last beginning to fully understand what that innocuous phrase, "the world has moved on," really meant. What a breadth of ignorance and evil it covered. And what a depth. The speakers were a wartime measure, Susanna thought. Of course they were. God only knows which war, or how long ago, but it must have been a doozy. The rulers of Lud used the speakers to make city-wide announcements from some central bomb-proof location. A bunker, like the one Hitler and his high command retreated to at the end of World War II. And in her ears she could hear the voice of authority which had come rolling out of those speakers. Could hear it as clearly as she had heard the creak of the wagons passing through River Crossing. As clearly as she had heard the crack of the whip above the backs of the straining oxen. Ration centers A and D will be closed today. Please proceed to centers B, C, E, and F with proper coupons. Militia squads 9, 10, and 12 report to send side. Aerial bombardment is likely between the hours of 8 and 10 of the clock. All non-combatant residents should report to their designated shelters. Bring your gas masks. Repeat, bring your gas masks.
Announcements. Yes. And some garbled version of the news. A propagandized, militant version George Orwell would have called doublespeak.
And in between the news bulletins and the announcements, squalling military music, and exhortations to respect the fallen by sending more men and women into the red throat of the abattoir. Then the war had ended, and silence had fallen for a while. But at some point, the speakers had begun broadcasting again. How long ago? 100 years? 50? Did it matter? Susanna thought not. What mattered was that when the speakers were reactivated, the only thing they broadcast was a single tape loop, the loop with the drum track on it. And the descendants of the city's original residents had taken it for... what? The voice of the turtle? The will of the beam? Susanna found herself remembering the time she had asked her father, a quiet but deeply cynical man, if he believed there was a God in heaven who guided the course of human events.
"Well," he had said, "I think it's sort of half and half, Odetta. I'm sure there's a God, but I don't think he has much, if anything, to do with us these days. I believe that after we kill his son, he finally got it through his head that there wasn't nothing to be done with the sons of Adam or the daughters of Eve, and he washed his hands of us. Wise fella."
She had responded to this, which she had fully expected. She was 11 at the time and knew the turn of her father's mind quite well, by showing him a squib on the community church's page of the local newspaper. It said that Reverend Murdoch of the Grace Methodist Church would that Sunday elucidate on the topic, "God speaks to each of us every day," with a text from 1 Corinthians. Her father had laughed over that so hard that tears had squirted from the corners of his eyes.
"Well, I guess each of us hears someone talking," he had said at last. "And you can bet your bottom dollar on one thing, sweetie. Each of us, including this here Reverend Murdoch, hears that voice say just exactly what he wants to hear. It's so convenient that way."
What these people had apparently wanted to hear in the recorded drum track was an invitation to commit ritual murder. And now, when the drums began to throb through these hundreds or thousands of speakers, a hammering backbeat which was only the percussion to a ZZ Top song called Velcro Fly, if Eddie was right, it became their signal to unlimber the hang ropes and run a few folks up the nearest speaker posts.
How many? She wondered, as Eddie rolled her along in her wheelchair, its nicked and dented hard rubber tires crackling over broken glass and whispering through drifts of discarded paper. How many have been killed over the years because some electronic circuit under the city got the hiccups? Did it start because they recognized the essential alienness of the music, which came somehow, like us and the airplane and some of the cars along these streets, from another world? She didn't know, but she knew she had come around to her father's cynical point of view on the subject of God and the chance he might or might not have with the sons of Adam and the daughters of Eve. These people had been looking for a reason to slaughter each other, that was all, and the drums had been as good a reason as any. She found herself thinking of the hive they had found, the misshapen hive of white bees whose honey would have poisoned them if they'd been foolish enough to eat of it.
Here, on this side of the Send, was another dying hive, more mutated white bees, whose sting would be no less deadly for their confusion, loss, and perplexity. And how many more will have to die before the tape finally breaks? As if her thoughts had caused it to happen, the speakers suddenly began to transmit the relentless, syncopated heartbeat of the drums. Eddie yelled in surprise. Susanna screamed and clapped both hands to her ears. But before she did, she could faintly hear the rest of the music. The track or tracks which had been muted decades ago when someone, probably quite by accident, had bumped the balance control, knocking it all the way to one side and burying both the guitars and the vocal. Eddie continued to push her along the street of the turtle and the path of the beam, trying to look in all directions at once and trying not to smell the odor of putrefaction. Thank God for the wind, he thought. He began to push the wheelchair faster, scanning the weedy gaps between the big white buildings for the graceful sweep of an overhead monorail track. He wanted to get out of this endless aisle of the dead. As he took yet another deep breath of that speciously sweet cinnamon smell, it seemed to him that he had never wanted anything so badly in his whole life. 19. Jake's daze was broken abruptly when Gasher grabbed him by the collar and yanked with all the force of a cruel rider breaking a galloping horse. He stuck one leg out at the same time, and Jake went crashing backward over it. His head connected with the pavement, and for a moment all the lights went out. Gasher, no humanitarian, brought him around quickly by seizing Jake's lower lip and yanking it upward and outward. Jake screamed and bolted to a sitting position, striking out blindly with his fists. Gasher dodged the blows easily, hooked his other hand into Jake's armpit, and yanked him to his feet. Jake stood there, rocking drunkenly back and forth. He was beyond protest now, almost beyond understanding. All he knew for sure was that every muscle in his body felt sprung, and his wounded hand was howling like an animal caught in a trap. Gasher apparently needed a breather, and this time he was slower getting his wind back. He stood bent over with his hands planted on the knees of his green trousers, panting in fast little whistling breaths. His yellow headscarf had slipped askew. His good eye glittered like a trumpery diamond. The white silk eye patch was now wrinkled, and curds of evil-looking yellow muck oozed onto his cheek from beneath it.
"Take a look over your head, Kelly, and you'll see why I brung you up short. Get an eyeful."
Jake tilted his head upward, and in the depths of his shock he was not at all surprised to see a marble fountain as big as a house trailer dangling 80 feet above them. He and Gasher were almost below it. The fountain was held suspended by two rusty cables which were mostly hidden within huge, unsteady stacks of church pews. Even in his less than acute state, Jake saw that these cables were more seriously frayed than the remaining hangers on the bridge had been.
"See it?" Gasher asked, grinning.
He raised his left hand to his covered eye, scooped a mass of the pussy material from beneath it, and flicked it indifferently aside.
"Beauty, ain't it? Oh, the TikTok man's a trig cove, all right, no mistake. Where's those goat-fucking drums? They should have started by now. If Copperhead's forgotten him, I'll ram a stick so far up his arse he'll taste bark. Now, look ahead of you, my delicious little squint."
Jake did, and Gasher immediately clouted him so hard that he staggered backward and almost fell.
"Not across, idiot child. Down. See them two dark cobblestones?"
After a moment, Jake did. He nodded apathetically.
"You don't want to step on them. For that, it'd bring the whole works down on your head, Kelly, and anybody who wanted you after that, he'd have to pick you up with a blotter. Understand?"
Jake nodded again.
"Good."
Gasher took a final deep breath and slapped Jake's shoulder.
"Go on, then. What you waiting for? Up!"
Jake stepped over the first of the discolored stones and saw it wasn't really a cobblestone at all, but a metal plate which had been rounded to look like one. The second was just ahead of it, cunningly placed so that if an unaware intruder happened to miss the first one, he or she would almost certainly step on the second.
"Go ahead and do it, then," he thought. "Why not? The gunslinger's never going to find you in this maze, so go ahead and bring it down. It's got to be cleaner than what Gasher and his friends have got planned for you. Quicker, too."
His dusty moccasin wavered in the air above the booby trap. Gasher hit him with a fist in the middle of the back, but not hard.
"Thinking about taking a ride on the Hansom, are you, my little cow?" he asked.
The laughing cruelty in his voice had been replaced by simple curiosity. If it was tinged with any other emotion, it wasn't fear, but amusement.
"Well, go ahead, if that's what you mean to do, for I have my ticket already. Only be quick about it, God's blast your eyes."
Jake's foot came down beyond the trigger of the booby trap. His decision to live a little longer was not based on any hope that Roland would find him. It was just that this was what Roland would do. Go on until someone made him stop, and then a few yards farther still if he could. If he did it now, he could take Gasher with him, but Gasher alone wasn't sufficient. One look was enough to make it clear that he was telling the truth when he said he was dying already. If he went on, he might have a chance to take some of the Gasher man's friends, too. Maybe even the one he called the TikTok man. "If I'm going to ride what he calls the Hansom," Jake thought, "I'd just as soon go with plenty of company." Roland would have understood. 20. Jake was wrong in his assessment of the gunslinger's ability to follow their path through the maze. Jake's pack was only the most obvious bit of sign they left behind them. But Roland quickly realized he did not have to pause to look for sign. He only had to follow Oi. He paused at several intersecting passages nevertheless, wanting to make sure. And each time he did, Oi looked back and uttered his low, impatient bark that seemed to say, "Hurry up, do you want to lose them?" After the signs he saw, a track, a thread from Jake's shirt, a scrap of bright yellow cloth from Gasher's scarf, had three times confirmed the bumbler's choices, Roland simply followed Oi. He did not give up looking for sign, but he quit making stops to hunt for it. Then the drums started up, and it was the drums, plus Gasher's nosiness about what Jake might be carrying, that saved Roland's life that afternoon. He skidded to a halt in his dusty boots, and his gun was in his hand before he realized what the sound was. When he did realize, he dropped the revolver back into its holster with an impatient grunt. He was about to go on again when his eye happened first on Jake's pack, and then on a pair of faint, gleaming streaks in midair just to the left of it. Roland narrowed his eyes and made out two thin wires which crisscrossed at knee level not 3 feet in front of him. Oi, who was built low to the ground, had scurried neatly through the inverted V formed by the wires, but if not for the drums and spotting Jake's cast-off pack, Roland would have run right into them. As his eyes moved upward, tracing the not-quite-random piles of junk poised on either side of the passageway at this point, Roland's mouth tightened. It had been a close call, and only Kaa had saved him. Oi barked impatiently. Roland dropped to his belly and crawled beneath the wires, moving slowly and carefully. He was bigger than either Jake or Gasher, and he realized a really big man wouldn't be able to get under here at all without triggering the carefully prepared avalanche. The drums pumped and thumped in his ears. "I wonder if they've all gone mad," he thought. "If I had to listen to that every day, I think I would have." He got to the far side of the wires, picked up the pack, and looked inside. Jake's books and a few items of clothing were still in there. So were the treasures he had picked up along the way, a rock which gleamed with yellow flecks that looked like gold but weren't, an arrowhead, probably the leaving of the old forest folk, which Jake had found in a grove of trees the day after his drawing, some coins from his own world, his father's sunglasses, a few other things which only a boy not yet in his teens could really love and understand. Things he would want back again. If, that was, Roland got to him before Gasher and his friends could change him, hurt him in ways that would cause him to lose interest in the innocent pursuits and curiosities of pre-adolescent boyhood. Gasher's grinning face swam into Roland's mind like the face of a demon or a genie from a bottle. The snaggled teeth, the vacant eyes, the mandrus crawling over the cheeks and spreading beneath the stubbly lines of the jaws. "If you hurt him," he thought, and then forced his mind away, because that line of thought was a blind alley. If Gasher hurt the boy, Jake, his mind insisted fiercely, not just the boy, but Jake, Jake! Roland would kill him, yes. But the act would mean nothing, for Gasher was a dead man already. The gunslinger lengthened the straps of the pack, marveling at the clever buckles which made this possible, slipped it onto his own back, and stood up again. Oi turned to be off, but Roland called his name, and the bumbler looked back. "To me, Oi." Roland didn't know if the bumbler could understand, or if he would obey even if he did, but it would be better, safer, if he stayed close. Where there was one booby trap, there were apt to be more. Next time, Oi might not be so lucky.
"Ake!"
Oi barked, not moving. The bark was assertive, but Roland thought he saw more of the truth about how Oi felt in his eyes. They were dark with fear. "Yes, but it's dangerous," Roland said. "To me, Oi." Back the way they had come, there was a thud, as something heavy fell, probably dislodged by the punishing vibration of the drums. Roland could now see speaker poles here and there, poking out of the wreckage like strange, long-necked animals. Oi trotted back to him and looked up, panting.
"Stay close." "Ake! Ake! Ake!"
"Yes, Jake." He began to run again, and Oi ran beside him, heeling as neatly as any dog Roland had ever seen. 21. For Eddie, it was, as some wise man had once said, deja vu all over again. He was running with the wheelchair, racing time. The beach had been replaced by the Street of the Turtle, but somehow everything else was the same. Well, there was one other relevant difference. Now it was a railway station, or a cradle, he was looking for, not a freestanding door. Susanna was sitting bolt upright, with her hair blowing out behind her and Roland's revolver in her right hand, its barrel pointed up at the cloudy, troubled sky. The drums thudded and pounded, bludgeoning them with sound. A gigantic, dish-shaped object lay in the street just ahead, and Eddie's overstrained mind, perhaps cued by the classical buildings on either side of them, produced an image of Jove and Thor playing frisbee. Jove throws one wide, and Thor lets it fall through a cloud. What the hell, it's Miller time on Olympus anyway. "Frisbees are the gods," he thought, swerving Susanna between two crumbling, rusty cars. What a concept. He bumped the chair up on the sidewalk to get around the artifact, which looked like some sort of telecommunications dish now that he was really close to it. He was easing the wheelchair over the curb and back into the street again. The sidewalk was too littered with crap to make any real time when the drums suddenly cut out. The echoes rolled away into a new silence, except it wasn't really silent at all, Eddie realized. Up ahead, the arched entrance to a marble building stood at the intersection of the Street of the Turtle and another avenue. This building had been overgrown by vines and some straggly green stuff that looked like cypress beards, but it was still magnificent and somehow dignified. Beyond it, around the corner, a crowd was babbling excitedly. "Don't stop," Susanna snapped. "We haven't got time to—" A hysterical shriek drilled through the babble. It was accompanied by yells of approval and, incredibly, the sort of applause Eddie had heard in Atlantic City hotel casinos after some lounge act had finished doing its thing. The shriek was choked into a long, dying gargle that sounded like the buzz of a cicada. Eddie felt the hair on the nape of his neck coming to attention. He glanced at the corpses hanging from the nearest speaker pole and understood that the fun-loving pubes of Ludd were holding another public execution. Marvelous, he thought. Now if they only had Tony Orlando and Dawn to sing Knack three times, they could all die happy. Eddie looked curiously at the stone pile on the corner. This close, the vines which overgrew it had a powerful herbal smell. That smell was eye-wateringly bitter, but he still liked it better than the cinnamon-sweet odor of the mummified corpses. The beards of greenery growing from the vines drooped in ratty sheaves, creating waterfalls of vegetation where once there had been a series of arched entrances. A figure suddenly barreled out through one of these waterfalls and hurried toward them. It was a kid, Eddie realized, and not that many years out of diapers, judging by the size. He was wearing a weird little Lord Fauntleroy outfit, complete with ruffled white shirt and velveteen short pants. There were ribbons in his hair. Eddie felt a sudden mad urge to wave his hands above his head and scream, "But we'd say Ludd is O-tay!" "Come on!" the kid cried in a high, piping voice. Several sprays of the green stuff had gotten caught in his hair. He brushed absently at these with his left hand as he ran.
They're gonna do spankers. It's the spanker man's turn to go to the land of the drums. Come on, or you'll miss the whole fakement, gods cuss it.
Susanna was equally stunned by the child's appearance, but as he got closer, it struck her that there was something extremely odd and awkward about the way he was brushing at the crumbles and strands of greenery which had gotten caught in his beribboned hair. He kept using just that one hand. His other had been behind his back when he ran out through the weedy waterfall, and there it remained. How awkward that must be, she thought. And then a tape player turned on in her mind, and she heard Roland speaking at the end of the bridge. I knew something like this could happen. If we'd seen the fellow earlier, while we were still beyond the range of his exploding egg, damn the luck! She leveled Roland's gun at the child, who had leaped from the curb and was running straight for them.
Hold it! She screamed. Stand still, you!
Suze, what are you doing? Eddie yelled.
Susanna ignored him. In a very real sense, Susanna Dean was no longer even here. It was Detta Walker in the chair now, and her eyes were glittering with feverish suspicion.
Stop or I'll shoot!
Little Lord Fauntleroy might have been deaf for all the effect her warning had.
"'House it!' he shouted jubilantly. "'You're going to miss your whole show! Spanker's going to—'
His right hand finally began to come out from behind his back. As it did, Eddie realized they weren't looking at a kid but at a misshapen dwarf whose childhood was many years past. The expression Eddie had at first taken for childish glee was actually a chilly mixture of hate and rage. The dwarf's cheeks and brow were covered with the oozing, discolored patches Roland called horse blossoms. Susanna never saw his face. Her attention was fixed on the emerging right hand and the dull green sphere it held. That was all she needed to see. Roland's gun crashed. The dwarf was hammered backward. A shrill cry of pain and rage rose from his tiny mouth as he landed on the sidewalk. The grenade bounced out of his hand and rolled back into the same arch through which he had emerged. Detta was gone, like a dream, and Susanna looked from the smoking gun to the tiny sprawled figure on the sidewalk with surprise, horror, and dismay.
Oh, my Jesus! I shot him! Eddie, I shot him!
Graves die!
Little Lord Fauntleroy tried to scream these words defiantly, but they came out in a bubbling choke of blood that drenched the few remaining white patches on his frilly shirt. There was a muffled explosion from inside the overgrown plaza of the corner building, and the shaggy carpets of green stuff hanging in front of the arches billowed outward like flags in a brisk gale. With them came clouds of choking, acrid smoke. Eddie flung himself on top of Susanna to shield her and felt a gritty shower of concrete fragments, all small ones, luckily, patter down on his back, his neck, and the crown of his head. There was a series of unpleasantly wet smacking sounds to his left. He opened his eyes a crack, looked in that direction, and saw little Lord Fauntleroy's head just coming to a stop in the gutter. The dwarf's eyes were still open, his mouth still fixed in its final snarl. Now there were other voices, some shrieking, some yelling, all furious. Eddie rolled off Susanna's chair, it tottered on one wheel before deciding to stay up, and stared in the direction from which the dwarf had come. A ragged mob of about 20 men and women had appeared, some coming from around the corner, others pushing through the mats of foliage which obscured the corner building's arches, materializing from the smoke of the dwarf's grenade like evil spirits. Most were wearing blue headscarves, and all were carrying weapons, a varied and somehow pitiful assortment of them, which included rusty swords, dull knives, and splintery clubs. Eddie saw one man defiantly waving a hammer. Pubes, Eddie thought. We interrupted their necktie party, and they're pissed as hell about it. A tangle of shouts, "Kill the Greys! Kill them both! They've done for Lester! God kill their eyes!" arose from this charming group as they caught sight of Susanna in her wheelchair and Eddie, who was now crouched on one knee before it. The man in the forefront was wearing a kilt-like wrap and waving a cutlass. He brandished this wildly, he would have decapitated the heavy-set woman standing close behind him had she not ducked, and then charged. The others followed, yelling happily. Roland's gun pounded its bright thunder into the windy, overcast day, and the top of the kilt-wearing pube's head lifted off. The sallow skin of the woman who had almost been decapitated by his cutlass was suddenly stippled with red rain, and she voiced a sound of barking dismay. The others came on past the woman and the dead man, raving and wild-eyed.
"Eddie!"
Susanna screamed and fired again. A man wearing a silk-lined cape and knee boots collapsed into the street. Eddie groped for the Ruger and had one panicky moment when he thought he had lost it. The butt of the gun had somehow slipped down inside the waistband of his pants. He wrapped his hand around it and yanked hard. The fucking thing wouldn't come. The sight at the end of the barrel had somehow gotten stuck in his underwear. Susanna fired three closely spaced shots. Each found a target, but the oncoming pubes didn't slow.
"Eddie, help me!"
Eddie tore his pants open, feeling like some cut-rate version of Superman, and finally managed to free the Ruger. He hit the safety with the heel of his left palm, placed his elbow on his leg just above the knee, and began to fire. There was no need to think, no need to even aim. Roland had told them that in battle a gunslinger's hands worked on their own, and Eddie now discovered it was true. It would have been hard for a blind man to miss at this range anyway. Susanna had cut the numbers of the charging pubes to no more than 15. Eddie went through the remainder like a storm wind in a wheat field, dropping 4 in less than 2 seconds. Now the single face of the mob, that look of glazed and mindless eagerness, began to break apart. The man with the hammer abruptly tossed his weapon aside and ran for it, limping extravagantly on a pair of arthritis-twisted legs. He was followed by 2 others. The rest of them milled uncertainly in the street.
"Come on, you deuces!"
a relatively young man snarled. He wore his blue scarf around his throat like a rally racer's ascot. He was bald except for 2 fluffs of frizzy red hair, one on each side of his head. To Susanna, this fellow looked like Clarabelle the Clown. To Eddie, he looked like Ronald McDonald. To both of them, he looked like trouble. He threw a homemade spear that might have started life as a steel table leg. It clattered harmlessly into the street to Eddie and Susanna's right.
"Come on, I say! We can get him if we all stick together!"
"Sorry, guy," Eddie murmured and shot him in the chest. Clarabelle Ronald staggered backward, one hand going to his shirt. He stared at Eddie with huge eyes that told his tale with heartbreaking clarity. This wasn't supposed to happen. The hand dropped heavily to the young man's side, a single runlet of blood, incredibly bright in the gray day, slipped from the corner of his mouth. The few remaining pubes stared at him mutely as he slipped to his knees, and one of them turned to run.
"Not at all," Eddie said. "Stay put, my retarded friend, or you're going to get a good look at the clearing where your path ends."
He raised his voice. "Drop 'em, boys and girls, all of 'em, now!"
"You," the dying man whispered, "you gunslinger?"
"That's right," Eddie said. His eyes surveyed the remaining pubes grimly.
"Cry your pardon,"
the man with the frizzy red hair gasped, and then he fell forward onto his face.
"Gunslingers?"
one of the others asked. His tone was one of dawning horror and realization.
"Well, you're stupid, but you ain't deaf," Susanna said, "and that's something anyway."
She waggled the barrel of the gun, which Eddie was quite sure was empty. For that matter, how many rounds could be left in the Ruger? He realized he didn't have any idea how many rounds the clip held, and cursed himself for a fool. But had he really believed it could come to something like this? He didn't think so.
"You heard him, folks. Drop 'em. Recess is over."
One by one, they complied. The woman who was wearing a pint or so of Mr. Sword and Kilt's blood on her face said,
"You shouldn't have killed Winston, missus. 'Twas his birthday, so it was."
"Well, I guess he should have stayed home and eaten some more birthday cake," Eddie said. Given the overall quality of this experience, he didn't find either the woman's comment or his own response at all surreal. There was one other woman among the remaining pubes, a scrawny thing whose long blonde hair was coming out in big patches as if she had the mange. Eddie observed her sidling toward the dead dwarf and the potential safety of the overgrown arches beyond him, and put a bullet into the cracked cement close by her foot. He had no idea what he wanted with her, but what he didn't want was one of them giving the rest of them ideas. For one thing, he was afraid of what his hands might do if the sickly, sullen people before him tried to run. Whatever his head thought about this gunslinging business, his hands had discovered they liked it just fine. "Stand where you are, beautiful. Officer Friendly says play it safe." He glanced at Susanna and was disturbed by the grayish quality of her complexion.
"Suze, you all right?"
he asked in a lower voice.
"Yes."
"You're not going to faint or anything, are you? Because
no."
She looked at him with eyes so dark they were like caves.
"It's just that I never shot anyone before, okay?"
"Well, you better get used to it," rose to his lips. He bit it back and returned his gaze to the five people who remained before them. They were looking at him and Susanna with a species of sullen fear, which nevertheless stopped well short of terror.
"Shit, most of them have forgotten what terror is," he thought.
"Joy, sadness, love, same thing.
I don't think they feel much of anything anymore. They've been living in this purgatory too long."
Then he remembered the laughter, the excited cries, the lounge-act applause, and revised his thinking. There was at least one thing that still got their motors running, one thing that still pushed their buttons. Spanker could have testified to that.
"Who's in charge here?" Eddie asked.
He was watching the intersection behind the little group very carefully in case the others should get their courage back. So far, he saw and heard nothing alarming from that direction. He thought that the others had probably left this ragged crew to its fate. They looked at each other uncertainly, and finally the woman with the blood-spattered face spoke up.
"Spanker was, but when the guy drum started up this time, it was Spanker's stone what come out of the hat, and we set him to dance. I guess Winston would come next, but you did for him with your god-rotted guns, so you did."
She wiped blood deliberately from her cheek, looked at it, and then returned her sullen glance to Eddie.
"Well, what do you think Winston was trying to do to me with his god-rotted spear?" Eddie asked.
He was disgusted to find the woman had actually made him feel guilty about what he had done.
"Trim my sideburns?"
"Killed Frank and Luster, too," she went on doggedly. "And what are you, either grays, which is bad, or a couple of god-rotted outlanders, which is worse? Who's left for the pubes in City North? Topsy, I suppose. Topsy the sailor, but he ain't here, is he? Took his boat and went off down river, eh? So he did, and God rot him, too," says I.
Susanna had ceased listening. Her mind had fixed with horrified fascination on something the woman had said earlier. It was Spanker's stone what come out of the hat, and we set him to dance. She remembered reading Shirley Jackson's story, The Lottery, in college, and understood that these people, the degenerate descendants of the original pubes, were living Jackson's nightmare. No wonder they weren't capable of any strong emotion when they knew they would have to participate in such a grisly drawing not once a year, as in the story, but two or three times each day.
"Why?" she asked the bloody woman in a harsh, horrified voice. "Why do you do it?"
The woman looked at Susanna as if she was the world's biggest fool.
"Why? Well, so the ghosts what live in the machines won't take over the bodies of those who have died here, pubes and grays alike, and send them up through the holes in the streets to eat us. Any fool knows that."
"There are no such things as ghosts," Susanna said.
And her voice sounded like so much meaningless quacking to her own ears. Of course there were. In this world, there were ghosts everywhere. Nevertheless, she pushed ahead.
"What you call the God drums is only a tape stuck in a machine. That's really all it is."
Sudden inspiration struck her, and she added, "Oh, maybe the Grays are doing it on purpose. Did you ever think of that? They live in the other part of the city, don't they? And under it as well? They've always wanted you out. Maybe they've just hit on a really efficient way of getting you guys to do their work for them." The bloody woman was standing next to an elderly gent wearing what looked like the world's oldest bowler hat and a pair of frayed khaki shorts. Now he stepped forward and spoke to her with a patina of good manners that turned his underlying contempt into a dagger with razor-sharp edges.
"You are quite wrong, Madam Gunslinger. There are a great many machines under Ludd, and there are ghosts in all of them, demonous spirits which bear only ill will to mortal men and women. These demon ghosts are very capable of raising the dead, and in Ludd there are a great many dead to raise."
"Listen," Eddie said, "have you ever seen one of these zombies with your own eyes, Jeeves? Have any of you?"
Jeeves curled his lip and said nothing. But that lip curl really said it all. What else could one expect, it asked, from outlanders who used guns as a substitute for understanding? Eddie decided it would be best to close off the whole line of discussion. He had never been cut out for missionary work anyway. He waggled the Ruger at the blood-stained woman.
You and your friend there, the one who looks like an English butler on his day off, are going to take us to the railroad station. After that, we can all say goodbye. And I'll tell you the truth, that's going to make my fucking day.
Railroad station? The guy who looked like Jeeves the butler asked.
What is a railroad station?
Take us to the cradle, Susanna said.
Take us to Blaine.
This finally rattled Jeeves. An expression of shocked horror replaced the world-weary contempt with which he had thus far